to Take a Breath with Matt and Tim. Today we're going to interview Simon Borg-Olivier, who's a physiotherapist and yoga practitioner. He's been one of Australia's leading yoga practitioners for many, many, many years. He combined his physiotherapy experience with his yoga experience to also write a fantastic book on yoga that we'll talk about in our interview. We certainly are really looking forward to interviewing him. He's also an expert on breath work and pranayama, and I've really been itching to ask him a few questions, and I'm looking forward to doing this interview. So I'm sure you'll enjoy what Simon has to share with us. We've got Simon Borg-Olivier with us today. Welcome to Take a Breath, Simon.
Thank you very much, Tim. Matt, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
A lot of people listening would probably heard of Simon. If you haven't, Simon's been teaching yoga for well over 30 years. He travels the world teaching yoga, running retreats, doing yoga teacher training. He started schools in Sydney, and I believe it's in Newtown, and in Bondi. He's written a book that's one of the Bibles of yoga, Applied Anatomy and Physiology of Yoga. He's very, very well known, really one of the doyens of Australian yoga, if you don't mind me heaving too much praise on you, and, you know, one of the leaders of world yoga. I'm also aware via the person, Roger Price, who trained me with breathing. Simon's been extremely interested in breathing and pranayama for most of his life as well, so I'm looking forward to asking you lots of questions. Before we start, however, we would like to know a little bit about the Simon before yoga. As in, how did you get into breathing and understanding and a knowledge of breathing and a use of breathing, and how did you get into yoga?
I was fortunate that my father taught me the essence of breathing when I was 6 years old. It was part of my swimming exercise. I had to swim an Olympic pool, and my bones are very heavy and I couldn't swim on top. I kept sinking. So my father, who was a free diver most of his life, taught me the essence of holding my breath to stay underwater. If you look at the free diving mythology, it goes right back to Indian yoga. The modern free divers, including the one that did the film The Big Blue, remember the movie called The Big Blue?
Yeah.
It's about a free diver. If you look at the history of the people who wrote that, they talk about how they were instructed by Indian yogis about breath retention. And so my father, you know, got part of that, and he taught me when I was 6 years old how to hold my breath in. So just after I was six, I think I could swim a lap of an Olympic pool underwater before I could swim it on top. And
wow,
that was a good introduction. I didn't know it was yoga at the time. And just after that, I met a man called Basil Brown, who was a Rhodesian, now Zimbabwean, javelin Olympic athlete. And he had been shown different types of yoga techniques, and he showed me Uddiyana Bandha and Nauli, which are the exercises where you basically expand your chest as if breathing into the chest but not breathing, and also isolating the rectus abdominis and the transverse abdominis, abdominal muscles, all done on a total exhalation retention. He showed me these quite advanced pranayama techniques, all done without holding the breath. That I got when I was 8 years old, and they were something I practiced right up until I met my first proper yoga teacher, who was a Tibetan Lama in 1977, you know, and he showed me the tantric yoga techniques that I still use today. So it was a good introduction about breathing. I learned more about breathing than I did than posture in the beginning.
Sounds like you're a yogi before you even knew it.
I don't know about yogi, but I learned something about breath anyway.
Yeah.
You went on to study at university. At that age, where did you think this was going to take you? Did you have an idea about what you wanted to do, or is it just developed?
I have two divergent lives that for a while were confusing me, because I went right along the science path and I did 3 degrees in biology, essentially. I started teaching yoga when I was in my early 20s. And then in my early 30s, after teaching yoga for 10 years, I had this problem. I was doing genetic engineering research at university and working as a lecturer in gene cloning and stuff like this. And I was also teaching yoga every day. And my professor at university said, you know, what is this? Why are you diversing your time, you know, doing two things at once? And he basically gave me an ultimatum. Either I quit teaching yoga or I continue as a professional molecular biologist. And so I actually chose yoga over it. But then I felt a little bit like I'd lost half of my life. So I went back to university as a student and enrolled in a physiotherapy degree in the early 1990s, because I thought that physiotherapy would be something where I could merge my passion for physical and physiological activities and science. So I became an exercise-based physiotherapist, and in that way I tried to merge my two passions, science and yoga.
Yeah, quite similar for me, because I was always interested in Chinese medicine and Tai Chi and the energetic side of healing. But at that stage in Melbourne, there was no Chinese medicine courses. So I thought, well, physio, it's kind of a natural therapy.
Yes, yes.
That was the closest thing that I could find. Yeah, it's quite similar.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. Yeah.
How have you found physio as a way of integrating that?
I really value my physiotherapy degree. And in the beginning, it really revolutionized my teaching. And I found myself spending a lot of time really working with neurology, especially with spinal reflexes. And I use spinal reflexes a lot in my therapeutic work for musculoskeletal problems. But then as I worked with it more and more, I started to realize there was a few problems with physiotherapy that now have mostly been rectified. A lot of problems with things like core stability and the way it was interpreted, some of the research on core stability in the 1980s, which has subsequently gone all around the world, but has since been refuted by physiotherapists, confused me for a while. And this is the stuff that I'm sure you're familiar with, the research in the late 1980s suggesting that...
Yes,
this sort of stuff. The idea that the person with a healthy back will be engaging their lower abdomen before they move, as opposed to the person with an unhealthy back will not engage the lower abdomen before they move. That whole research was a little bit misunderstood, and so they tried to make normal people engage the lower abdomen, whereas actually what they should have been saying was more like the lower abdomen, or what we can call the core, should engage before you move. But how does it engage was not clear. The way I realized it after many years was that if you tell someone, pull your lower abdomen in, you can get up to 12 different responses, and not all of them were the responses that the physiotherapists of the 1980s were expecting. So to actually realize the core stability paradigm, the one that's saying let's protect your lower back, was strongly interacting with the breathing paradigm. And this started to make me realize that when you're talking to people about their physical bodies and, say, protecting their lower back when doing dangerous exercises, you may be interfering with natural breathing. And once you start interfering with natural breathing, you start mucking around with people's physiology and hence their energetics as well. And it sort of makes sense. So because physiotherapy, in other words, helped me on one level, but it also disabled me in one level as well in the beginning. I think I've since reconciled it, but certainly physiotherapy helped me to help teach people with musculoskeletal problems. But you can't just fix someone's musculoskeletal problems up at the cost of stuffing up their physiology. And that's what happened in the beginning for me, I think.
That's interesting. As a non-physio, for me, when I started learning more and more about breathing, was that, I was learning to breathe when I was exercising, but I was also told certain things about how to stabilize that felt like it compromised my breathing. And so
at that stage,
it was confusing for me. It was
I
didn't want to compromise my breathing, yet I also wanted to stabilize. So
we can talk about that more at length because it's a big one, actually.
And maybe another episode.
Talking with Craig Phillips, started Clinical Pilates in Australia because I worked with him years ago. And the Pilates, and this is one of the things that we wanted to talk about, is exactly this. And it'll be so interesting to hear the founder of Clinical Pilates, which is teaching all the physios about this core stuff. Yeah, it'll be fascinating to find out where his thinking is and teaching around that as well.
This is a very, very big thing for me.
It sounds like you've taken that scientific mind, but you're always applying that to your clinical work and to your yoga work.
I can't really buy anything unless it's got some sort of scientific, logical justification. So most of the yoga that I took on board, I had to find scientific justification for. Otherwise, it just didn't make sense. A few things I could feel and then had to really search to find the scientific reason for them. But always, because of my training, I have to go back to the science to make sure at least there's some possibility that it makes scientific sense, not just ooga booga in my head. I can't work with yoga like that.
How do you go about that, Simon?
As much as possible, I try and use scientific method to try and work out if techniques are working. Scientific method has got lots of flaws, of course, and when you're trying to do reductionist science on a subject like yoga, which is a holistic science, there's always going to be problems. But as much as I can, I try and see what is having the effect. I try and change only one variable at a time if I'm trying to see what something is doing. I try and see first if it works on just one person, then see if it can work reproducibly on other people. As much as I can, I try and validate my work and also see if I can find evidence in the scientific literature to suggest that maybe a hypothesis that I've got is actually valid or has some basis in other people's heads as well.
Have you been formally documenting this?
As much as I can, yeah, but I'm not sure if it's stuff that I can readily publish.
With regards to coming back a little bit, although it's very much integrated, your background started off with breathing and free diving and what have you. How much of that have you integrated into your practice as a practitioner? Have you always been strong in emphasizing breathing with your students? Yeah. And also, are you still practicing it yourself? Of course, you're going to practice breathing because you're alive, but are you practicing breathing techniques?
I practice breathing techniques every day. If I do nothing else for my body each day, I'll at least do some breathing exercises. Because of its nature, I generally try and make the first step of introducing breathing to my students to be the restoration of natural breathing. And I just find I get a much better result with people on a physical, physiological, mental level in terms of general life function if I restore natural breathing as a first step. Although for individuals, I might choose for one individual to say, no, I'm going to teach you breathing first. If you were to say to me, Simon, we've got 1,000 people, you've never met them before, but we're going to put you in front of 1,000 people and I want you to give them something which is going to make them feel better, what can you offer for 1,000 people? What I would give them in terms of breathing would be natural breathing. I would not give them anything more than that because I find that there's much better things I can give to 1,000 people to give a better result on a physical, physiological, mental level than breathing. And that may be controversial in this field, but I think that most people's breathing is so stuffed up that if you try and give them any sort of breathing, the first thing that's going to happen is they're probably going to become over tense or over breathe. And that's with pretty much any breathing technique. And I'm talking about the general group, what I'm going to get in terms of physical, physiological, mental benefits on a short term and a long term. That's not to say that breathing exercises won't work, but if I have to give people something, I'd rather give them something to do with simple posture and movement and make them breathe naturally.
I've found that clinically as well, and you're familiar with a device that I use, a capnometer that was introduced via Roger Price, who was the guy that taught me about breathing. And it's a biofeedback technology that measures our breathing efficiency based on the principles of the Bohr effect, which is discussed in our first Tech Talk podcast that you can go back and have a look at. What I've found is that when we're measuring people's breathing, I think I've only ever measured one person that was able to breathe to what they would call medically diagnostic norms or was able to functionally breathe that hadn't had previous training. And even a lot of those with previous training, when we diverted their attention away from their breathing, weren't able to breathe to functional norms. And we were testing triple Olympic gold medalists, opera singers, yoga teachers, and a lot of people weren't able to breathe functionally, including myself. I was appalling.
Yes. As soon as you start to direct people's attention to their breath usually becomes physiologically worse. They start to overbreathe. And so to actually teach people to do better than natural breathing is actually quite challenging. There are benefits you can get from giving various breathing techniques. They might be physical, physiological. They might help your internal organs. They can give better strength, give better mental focus. But if you had to say, what's going to make someone feel better in the long term, the best thing I think you can do for most people is to restore natural breathing, but get them to exercise as well. You get them to do some physical activity and restore natural breathing.
You mentioned the word overbreathe. Most people overbreathe. Can you clarify that, please?
If you measure the average, I mean, this is not for you guys, but for the listeners perhaps, but if you were to measure the average person's amount they breathe per minute, so you measure the amount of breaths they take per minute and the amount of air per breath, this is called a minute ventilation, obviously, and the minute ventilation at rest, you usually is about 5 liters, according to most medical textbook. Most people breathe about 5 liters of air per minute, which might be 10 little breaths of 500 mils each, say, or 20 250 mil breaths. And that 5 liters of air per minute will allow them to function normally if they're just sitting, say, not doing anything special. If they breathe more than 5 liters per minute, this is called hyperventilation. If they breathe less than that 5 liters per minute, it'll be called hypoventilation. And you generally get best results for people if they breathe as little as possible doing the activity they're doing. If you had to say what's better, hyperventilation or hypoventilation, I would say if you get people to do a healthy activity and you get them to breathe as little as possible while they're doing the activity they're doing in a non-stressful way, then you're probably better off having them hypoventilate than hyperventilate. And a person who is, say, an Olympic runner, if they're hardly breathing at all while they're running, you'll call them a fit person. But someone who is, say, walking normally and breathing a lot, you'll call them a sick person. Yet in the modern world, you hear people saying, you should breathe more, you should breathe more, whereas actually logically we know that fit people actually breathe less.
We're not looking for deep breathing, we're looking for slow, steady, gentle breathing. The average person breathes far too often. Yeah.
I've been teaching Wim Hof method to a lot of my patients because it's very simple, it's very succinct, and it's not overly complicated. How do you actually go about teaching breathing to people as an exercise?
The first thing I like to do with most of my clients is give them a restoration of natural breathing. If it's an individual client, I'll always look at the possibility that a particular modality may be the best thing for them. The difference is, if I've got 1,000 people at once, what would I give 1,000 people? If I've got one person, the best thing may be to give them a specific breathing technique, or it may be to give them a postural technique. But if I had to say what's the best thing to give 1,000 people at once, I would only give them breathing, which is natural breathing in the beginning. Because I find that if you give any other sort of breathing, and I love the Wim Hof method because it's a specific yoga technique in a simple form, then I find that I get better responses overall if I give them something other than breathing and I just restore natural breathing.
Because my background came a bit from the Buteyko understanding, studying the physiology and biochemistry of breathing via Bohr effect with capnometry. I've worked a lot on understanding natural breathing. And when the Wim Hof technique came out, I saw some fantastic results that he'd got and a great enthusiasm about breathing. And the difficulty initially was, how does that fit within the space? And I listened to a couple of lectures and podcasts from Professor Mark Cohen, fingers crossed we'll be interviewing soon as well, that it all fits beautifully. It's a specific technique, and it was really nice the way he explained it. It's around performance and achieving particular outcomes. With regards to natural breathing, how would you classify or describe natural breathing?
Okay, I have five features that I say would constitute natural breathing. One is that the inhalation is felt very low, which we could call diaphragmatic breathing if you like, although people argue about that sometimes. The sensation that if you were to continue inhaling, the first place you would feel it physically would be low in the pelvic floor or in the lower abdomen or lower back. That's inhalation. Then the second thing about natural breathing is that exhalation is passive. There are no additional muscular activations that will be done to make an exhalation happen. You just let the air out and it goes out passively with elastic recoil of whatever breathing muscles you inhale. The third thing about natural breathing is that it's minimal. It's no more than you actually need. It is at rest, invisible, inaudible breath. And if you're running fast, you're not trying to breathe more than your body would want to be breathing. The fourth thing about natural breathing is that it can run on automatic. You can forget about it and it happens by itself, the same way as it would when you're asleep. And the fifth thing about natural breathing is that it generally is through the nose. It's the things that I try and restore back into people when I'm giving them the first types of physical exercise. And the thing that I'll ask them to do between any specific breathing exercise that I might try and give them, I want to restore natural breathing. Most people haven't got it.
About our first three or four tech talks, particularly the third and fourth one, we talk about what is breathing according to diagnostic norms and what is the role of the diaphragm with the nervous system. So listeners can certainly go and listen to those podcasts that we have recorded on what we would call natural breathing, or the breathing the way we're built to, and the role of the diaphragm in breathing and with our nervous system. Have you got information or videos or things that people could look at as well?
You can go to both of my websites. One of them is yogasynergy.com, and that's got a whole bunch of blogs attached to it where I've discussed breathing at length in many of them. They're also attached to our YouTube site, which is called Yoga Synergy as well, YogaSynergy. And I also have a fair bit about breathing and a course on breathing at my other website called simonborgolivier.com, myholename.com. And there's a whole course on breathing and there's a bunch of stuff that's free with that as well. So that's where I talk about it most, perhaps.
And that'll be linked in our show notes, as well links to the Take a Breath podcast and Take a Breath's website as well. We'll be able to provide links.
I love doing breathing exercises, but I just think that unless you can give someone the ability to remember how to breathe naturally, as they did when they were children, then most breathing exercises will only have limited benefit to people. All exercises to do with breathing will have limited benefits.
When I'm working with people with, say, asthma, or those with snoring and apnea, or breathing difficulties or anxiety or headaches and migraines and a whole range of type of ailments, all we're trying to do again is to restore natural breathing as well. Because most people overbreathe, as you suggested, that often contributes. I won't go into detail with that, but we have certainly discussed it in those tech talks I referred to before. That contributes to symptoms of a number of illnesses, and restoring natural breathing, we found, helps remove a lot of those symptoms, or certainly helps to reduce them significantly. So there is a huge benefit for the average person in restoring natural breathing.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about what I do beyond that as well.
One question, because it is a question about beyond that. I spoke to a colleague once who said that he had spent some time with you doing capnometry, etc. And he said that you sat on the floor and held your breath for 6.5 minutes. Is that true? And if so, yes, how long can you hold your breath for?
About 6.5 minutes is my maximum. Maybe I can tell you a little bit about why I think, say, the Wim Hof method, for example, is excellent and where its limitations are. Every technique has the possibility of being excellent for at least some people and can also have problems with other people. And maybe I could discuss the limitations of that since Matt was talking about it as well.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Right.
Wim Hof is an incredible practitioner. You know, personally, he's just an amazing man, and I've thoroughly enjoyed every interaction that I've had with him. And I know many people who have walked away from his seminars just completely changed, that changed their life.
I finished up at Wim Hof saying goodbye to women about 1 o'clock last night. And there was a lot of people very, very buzzed up after that workshop.
Yeah, and I've been working with Mark Cohen for the last 10 years, and I had a lovely sauna and swim with him 2 days ago, actually, and he was just with Wim that afternoon in Gold Coast. I would have loved to have come, but I had my daughter's birthday party and I couldn't come for that. What I was going to say is that every technique can have really positive benefits for an individual, but may have limitations at a small frequency, which you'll notice if you say, teach it to 1,000 people at once. Wim's technique is a simplified version of a very complex yoga technique, which has many different names, and the one I know it to be is called Shakti Chalani Pranayam. To teach that is quite complex and involves a lot more than just the simple things that Wim has asked people to do, but it definitely is contained within that. If I do my version of, say, what Wim is teaching, which is not as complex as the Shakti Chalani Pranayam, but contains the same elements, I feel incredible. And let me tell you what I did one time, and then how it's modified in different ways. With Mark Cohen and myself and a research scientist got together at RMIT University some years ago, I sat on a chair with a gas mask on, which would measure carbon dioxide and oxygen expelled out of my breath and measure those things with a computer. What I did was I hyperventilated for 5 minutes. I did full breath in, full breath out for 5 minutes. It was about 3 seconds in, 3 seconds out, which would mean that I'm doing about 50 liters of air in a minute, so for 5 minutes, which is 10 times the amount of normal breathing, right? And certainly at the end of that 5 minutes, I had full tetanus and all sorts of tingling in fingers, disorientation. It was a lot of hyperventilation. And I said to the scientist, Mark, I'm going to sit on the edge of the chair and I won't rest my back on the edge of the chair. Otherwise, if you see me resting my back on the edge of the chair, you'll know I've either spaced out or passed out. Because as you know, and maybe our listeners should know, that the dangers of hyperventilation would be that it's possible for you to pass out if you overdo it. Wim makes this a lot safer by teaching people hyperventilation while lying on their back. So if they were to faint, they're only lying on the floor. Because the danger is not the fainting, of course. The danger is fainting while standing, that you might fall over and hit your head and you could die. Or if you faint underwater, of course, you could drown. So always hyperventilate in a safe place. Because I'm used to it, I did it sitting on a chair with a gas mask on. At the end of that time, my intention was to hold my breath. And at the time, this was some years ago, my maximum breath retention was about 4.5 minutes, I think it was. I hyperventilated, and then I just finished my last breath and then held my breath. And when I held my breath, I pressed the little timer to hold the breath, and then I closed my eyes and went through the process of how to hold my breath significantly. And I go through a series of connecting my mind with different parts of my body, in particular the parts of my body which have dual control between the conscious and the unconscious nervous system. And in that way, I can hold my breath a fairly long time. What I found was that in the beginning, there was a lot of disorientation, which is what you normally feel when you first hold your breath after hyperventilation. There's this dizziness. I couldn't even work out whether I was right side up or upside down, you know, very disorientating. But after some time, I felt okay. And then because I'd been there for quite a while, while, I thought, gee, I feel fine. I don't feel the urge to breathe because, of course, when you hyperventilate, you blow off the carbon dioxide, which is your main signal to breathe. Because I'd breathed so much, I had no carbon dioxide or little carbon dioxide, no urge to breathe. But I thought, gee, I've been here for a while. Maybe I'll check how long I've been here for. And I opened my eyes and it already was 5 minutes. And I thought, okay, well, I'll close my eyes again. I'll keep holding my breath. But I was a bit skeptical thinking, gee, maybe I'll pass out if I hold my breath any longer because I've never held my breath this long before. But I thought, okay, I'll push it a little bit further. So I closed my eyes again. And eventually, although I didn't really feel the urge to breathe, I opened my eyes, saw that it was after 6 minutes and thought, well, okay, I don't want to push it. I don't like fainting. I don't want to fall over and hit my head because I have done that once before. So I just simply calmly took a little breath in, a little breath out, breathe in, breathe out. Then I observed that I felt good. I mean, not just good, but really good. And not really good like spaced out. I wasn't like going, woo, you know, there was no sort of disorientation. There was no dizziness, nausea, queasiness, which sometimes people go, wow, I feel amazing. It's like on drugs. No, I felt grounded. I felt calm, clear, focused, warm, nourished, good, like I'd never felt that good in my life. And it was such a good feeling, but clear and focused. I was reflecting on it, but also just enjoying it. And then at one point I thought, well, maybe I can't just sit here forever. I'd better talk to Mark and the scientist. So I calmly opened my eyes and I looked at the guy and he said, I'm sorry, I don't understand what's just happened. And I said, what do you mean? What's just happened? He said, well, you told me you were going to hold the breath. And I said, I did. I held my breath. And he said, but no, you held the breath twice. And I said, what do you mean? And he showed me the computer graphical readout. And it showed inhale, exhale for 5 minutes, 3 seconds in, 3 seconds out. And at the end of that time, it just sort of showed me holding my breath for 6 and something minutes. Then after that, it showed me exhaling a bit, inhaling a bit, exhale a bit, inhale a bit, and then another flat line. And according to the computer, after that point, which was 6 minutes breath retention, then two little breaths, it looked, according to the computer, that I did not breathe at all for the next 8 minutes.
Wow.
For me, I thought I was just sitting there going, I feel good, I feel good. And what stopped me actually in that thing was just the feeling that I've got two people watching me and I should maybe talk to them. But according to that computer, in that time when I was feeling better than I've possibly ever felt in my life, I was not breathing for 8 minutes. And in yoga, this is called Kevala Kumbhaka. A Kumbhaka is a breath retention, but a Kevala Kumbhaka is one that you do spontaneously and you don't even realize you're holding your breath. And this was quite remarkable. And I felt good for a couple of days afterwards. I was warm, I was healthy, and it was a very cold time of the year. This, I believe, is what Wim is doing in his practice. But note what it took for me to do it. I hyperventilated for 5 minutes, and then I held my breath for more than 6 minutes. Just the other day, I was with Mark Cohen in Melbourne. In January, I think I was with Mark in Melbourne, and he was doing his regular morning Wim Hof practice. Mark is a very, very smart man, and he's very, very capable of looking after himself physically. He hasn't perhaps had the breathing experience that I've had. So when he did his Wim Hof exercise in the morning, he hyperventilated for a few minutes and then he held his breath for more than 3 minutes. To hold your breath for more than 3 minutes for someone who's not been training in that way is quite significantly impressive. And I hyperventilated same time as him. And when he finished his breath retention, he looked at me and I'm sort of lying there. I held my breath for about 4.5 minutes. But after 4.5 minutes of holding my breath, 1.5 minutes goes quite slowly when someone is staring at you. So I thought, well, this is long enough. I don't have to hold my breath longer. But I continued then and just breathed normally. And I felt okay, but I did not feel the level of okay that I felt when I held my breath for 6 minutes. I didn't even feel averagely okay. It felt a little bit unbalanced still. What I'm coming to is that when you hyperventilate, you make your pH shift into the alkaline range. You become much more alkaline. When you hypoventilate, when you breathe less than normal, you become a little bit more acidic. And I think just in terms of pH alone, you need to balance the pH. Hyperventilation makes you alkaline. Holding your breath afterwards can make you more acidic, but you must reach that neutrality. And if not, you leave your pH unbalanced, and that can shift your whole physiology. And so what I'd like to see is people learning hypoventilation before they learn how to hyperventilate. In other words, I think I only got the best results when I personally held my breath for 6.5 minutes. Someone else will get the best results if they hold their breath for 4 minutes. But I don't believe that people are going to comfortably be able to hold their breath long enough unless they first learn how to hold their breath in. So when I teach something akin to the Wim Hof method, what I will do first is get people comfortably holding their breath without hyperventilating. And once they've learned the effects of holding the breath and the various things that you need to learn physically, physiologically, and mentally to hold the breath, and the importance of holding the breath, then I'll teach hyperventilation first. So basically, if you make someone just hyperventilate, many people will love it because what they'll get is the effects of reducing blood flow to the brain, which is a bit like marijuana, the effects of stimulating cortisol and adrenaline, a bit like coffee and cocaine, and endorphins, which is a bit like heroin. So if they just hyperventilate at the end, some people will go, wow, I feel amazing. In yoga, they call it a pranic high. I'm on a pranic high. I feel incredible. No, you're just stoned on the body's own coffee, cocaine, marijuana, heroin at the same time, which is not what Wim's doing, but what many people might be doing unless they first were told how to do things sensibly, safely, and intelligently with the right science behind it.
So Simon, you said before on your course, it's a week into 1 month course. You've taught people how to hold their breath. In a couple of minutes, could you give us a few pointers about that breath holding technique, what the essence of what you're teaching there?
If I'm getting people to hold the breath, in the beginning, the safest place to hold it, what Wim does is, you know, he gets people not to hold the breath fully in, not to hold the breath fully out, but just to hold the breath at that mid-range, you know, tidal volume. And that's the safest place to learn breath retention. Tim probably does it in the Buteyko technique, they call it controlled pause. I teach them controlled pause first. The things that I find help most, if they do it in a place which is comfortable, they've got to be in a comfortable position first, either sitting or lying comfortably, and you get them to connect with what I call the 12 bridges between conscious and unconscious. And these 12 bridges relate to this modern concept that many people say that breathing is the link between body and mind. Have you heard that sort of thing? That breathing is the link between conscious and unconscious. But of course, it's not breathing itself. It's the diaphragm, because the diaphragm is a muscle that can be controlled both consciously and unconsciously. So you can easily tell someone breathe into your abdomen or breathe diaphragmatically. But if you don't tell them that, if they're just lying asleep or just watching television, they tend to be breathing diaphragmatically anyway. So the diaphragm is a muscle you can control both consciously and unconsciously. And that's what makes it a special place in the body, a link between somatic and autonomic or conscious and unconscious nervous system. But it's not unique. There are at least 11 other places in the body which have that same property. So for example, the muscles that control your blinking reflex, we can control blinking consciously, but if someone slaps in front of your face, you might blink unconsciously. Similarly, the inner eye muscles, the muscles that make your eyes roll back and forth, they also have both conscious and unconscious control. Like when you open someone's eyes when they're asleep, they're often rolled back, or maybe you can see my eyes right now, they're going a bit wide. Can you see them?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm consciously pushing my eyes upwards, but that's what someone does unconsciously when they're asleep. So the 11 places other than the diaphragm surprisingly include the fingers and toes, or their relation to hips and shoulders, also the pelvic floor, front, back and middle, neck, the salivary or swallowing apparatus, jaw, the lips, the outer eyes and the inner eyes. So I get people to connect with these, what I'll call 12 bridges between conscious and unconscious. People will find that if they're holding their breath and they're having a little bit of trouble holding their breath, I get them to blink a couple of times, to roll their eyes a little bit, to move their jaw a little bit, to move their lips a little bit, to make saliva and swallow it, to move their fingers a little bit and their shoulders, to move their toes a little bit, to let their abdomen relax and maybe roll a little bit, to expand the pelvic floor, like about to urinate or about to defecate, or, you know, let their genitals relax. And these things will actually allow them to hold their breath much longer, most people find.
Wow, I have to go and try that. That's great.
Mark Cohen said this actually helped him. And Mark was very useful for me, because Mark, as a medical doctor, when I first said the bridges between conscious and unconscious, I didn't have to tell him those things. He knew those places, because as a medical practitioner, you know the things that have dual control, both conscious and unconscious.
Most people say when you hold your breath, after quite a short amount of time, you'll often feel the urge to swallow. That would explain that, I'm assuming, yes.
Yes, and swallowing is one of those things. If you swallow while holding your breath, you can hold your breath a few seconds longer. And usually if I'm desperate to breathe before I breathe, I will always teach and practice, make a swallow before you breathe, because it gives you a few seconds longer, because the body knows you can't actually breathe while swallowing. It triggers a reflex in the brain that says, don't breathe, you don't need to.
Another question around that slightly differently. If I'm exercising and I'm nose breathing at a high level of exercise, which you can train your body to do using your diaphragm, using your nose. For example, you mentioned the lips as a contact point. Would licking the lips actually assist your body's ability to nose breathe better at higher levels?
I think it would, because one of these bridges between conscious and unconscious is the ability to create saliva and swallow it. So that saliva and swallowing thing means if you can't wet your lips, you're probably too stressed and probably in a sympathetic nervous system state. So wetting your lips actually creates a little bit of saliva to do that, and it also makes the lips a little bit more mobile. So someone who is very stressed is someone whose lips are dry and tight. So by wetting them, you create saliva and you also help mobilize the lips. That would certainly resonate with me as being something that would help them. Okay, there's another thing as well. Although I think that natural breathing is a good way to be with breathing, it's not alone by itself going to help people. It's not enough for me to say to you, look, you need to get people to breathe naturally. That as a modality is not healthy by itself for most people. You need to do something physical as well. You can't just say to someone, I want you to relax and just sit at your desk all day and breathe naturally. That's not going to be of any use. I want to see people moving, and I want to see people moving their trunk especially. And one of my pet hates in the world of modern fitness is things like engage the core, because it's not wrong to engage the core. It's not wrong to use your abdominal muscles. But if engaging the core inhibits natural breathing and inhibits the diaphragm, I think it causes problems. And the other pet hate I have is the constant reminder that many people still say for reestablishing neutral spine, because if you just have a neutral spine the whole time, also that would cause dysfunction in breathing. Another pet hate that I have in the yoga world is for having people say, take your arms up in the air and pull the shoulders down, because that also inhibits breathing to a certain extent. What I like to do if I get 1,000 people for the first time is teach natural breathing and get them to move their trunk. I want them to move their trunk, especially move their spine in simple ways like flexion, extension, lateral flexion, twisting, etc. And if I just get them to move their spine through their 8 natural spinal movements, that will change natural breathing to breathing which actually is better than most people's attempt at pranayama. That's what I find. I wonder what Matt has to say about that.
I had for me to say, Simon, I'm not teaching in that kind of way. Probably not teaching it at such a sophisticated level, I don't think.
I would love to share this with you, maybe in another medium. What I try and get people to do, rather than tell them to breathe specifically, I get them to move their trunk in specific ways that makes their breathing change. By making them move in certain ways, I can get them, for example, to unconsciously increase their breathing while exercising. So they'll be breathing a little bit more than normal, but they're also moving a bit more than normal. So the net effect is still hypoventilation, but they're actually changing their breathing and they're putting the breath into different parts of their lungs. So that way then, they're also cleaning their lungs, they're also affecting heart rate variability, and they're also hypoventilating while improving lung capacity at the same time. And I find this is the best way to work with breathing for the general public without specifically telling them to do anything more than natural breathing. And at the same time, then they're getting benefits physically, physiologically, mentally. Then.
Yes. Now you describe it in that way. That's what I'm doing when I teach my basic Tai Chi and Qigong exercises.
I think you're right.
Exactly what you're doing with the Tai Chi. My teacher asked his teacher, who was one of the great modern masters of Tai Chi, how should we breathe? And he said, as you are.
As you are, exactly.
When you're doing Tai Chi correctly, the breathing is correct naturally.
It makes the body breathe for you in an enhanced functional way. People have told me recently, Matt, that my yoga in some ways in the base level that I teach looks more like Tai Chi Qigong. I've never learned Tai Chi or Qigong, but when you reduce the intensity of most people's modern yoga and you get rid of the overstretching and overtensing that most people tend to do, then it looks a little bit more like Tai Chi. That's what I've been told. And so I think you and I are doing something very, very similar. And if you you get people to breathe naturally while doing simple movements other than just sitting on a desk, they're going to probably enhance their breathing, in which case their physiology and their nervous system and their cardiopulmonary system and their musculoskeletal system start to work a lot better. Get people to move naturally and breathe naturally, they get a better result than just get people to exercise or breathe in specific ways.
I found it was making me tired afterwards, and my partner's found this. She's got right back into her yoga, really upped her practice. She's exhausted. And I think this is a lot of people's experience as well. They find it quite tiring. What do you think is going on there?
I think what's going on is that most yoga in the modern world that's being taught as yoga is no longer yoga. It's certainly not what I was being taught in the 70s and 80s by people who are perceived to be proper yoga teachers like BKS Iyengar and Patabi Joyce. Most of what's being taught now is, in my opinion, over-tensing, over-stretching, over-breathing, and over-thinking, or not thinking at all at times when perhaps they should in order to be safe in what they're doing. And so what happens is they're blocking the movement of energy and information through their body. The way I see what yoga should be on a physiological level is the enhancement of energy, in other words, things like blood flow through the body and information, but particularly you want information from the parasympathetic nervous system, not the sympathetic nervous system, going through the body. So if I have to say it in the wishy-washy way, I'll say that yoga is the circulation of energy and loving information through the body. If I say it scientifically, I say to get yoga in someone's body, I want to enhance blood flow without enhancing heart rate. I want to enhance blood flow while stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system to be dominant rather than sympathetic nervous system. And I think what most people do as yoga is more like a workout where they get the blood to flow, but they're doing it by over-tensing, over-stretching, making the heart beat too fast. And the body perceives heart rate increase, breath rate increase as being something to do with sympathetic nervous system. The body perceives anything to do with stretch or tension as being sympathetic nervous system. So then you're not getting loving information through the body. You're getting information which is saying fear, anger, aggression, lack of safety. And at the same time, this is turning off immune system, digestive system, reproductive system. And basically, it means that all the activities that will normally energize you and give you rejuvenation, relaxation, the things for longevity are being turned off. And so then it becomes a workout. A workout at the end of your practice, if you've got less energy and more tired, I'll call that a workout. If at the end of your practice, you've got more energy and less need for food or sleep, we'll call that physical yoga. It's not what most people are doing. You're doing it in your Tai Chi and Qigong, I imagine, though.
On that note, we're talking about yoga, but I was walking along the street and I saw a guy who'd just been for a workout, and this was not yoga. It was, I couldn't figure out if he'd just done gym or been for a run, but he was so stressed and so sort of hyper-vigilant afterwards. I was like, look, I get that exercise is better than doing nothing. Basically, I got the sense of looking at him. It wasn't that I had my radar up like you and Matt might. He just looked like he, well, literally the word is smashed himself. I just questioned and thought, there has to be a point of balance.
I have now observed my own body and the bodies of all my yoga friends and my exercise friends, because I know many from the late 70s and early 80s, as I was born in 1960, right? So from 18 onwards, I took my exercise seriously and I did a lot of breathing and exercise and yoga and conventional exercise and physiotherapy exercise, etc. So I've observed now people for 40 years almost as an adult, and I've not seen that many good results with conventional exercise or modern yoga. And this to me is very disturbing. What I'd like to be seeing is that people who get to their 50s and 60s look healthier, but they're not. Most people in the world of modern yoga over the age of 40 or 50 have as much problems with joint problems as the average person. And in fact, the average person who does no exercise, who just lives a regular life of going for a walk and stuff like this, often looks better than your average athlete or sincere physical yoga practitioner, which is disturbing to me. Basically, a lot of the yoga and exercise that people do, I think, is overstressing people's joints. And it's also really compromising people's physiology in terms of their immune system, reproductive system, digestive system. And you see that in people in their 50s and 60s. They don't look young anymore. The ones who did the most exercise and the most modern yoga often look very, very compromised. And I think that my yoga has improved a lot in the last 10 or 15 years, especially since I backed off with all the much stronger poses and much more intense stuff. I think that if you're going to do stressful exercise, leave it for your teenage years. By the time you get to 18 or 19, I think we don't want to be doing the strong exercises that many people are doing. And although you might get limited benefits in strength or flexibility, I don't think this is going to help your longevity. It's a controversial thing. Now, I understand it's controversial to say these sort of things, but basically, if you're not fit and strong to the level that you want by the time you're 18, I think leave it. I think just be happy with what you've got, because although you might get better levels of strength and flexibility and fitness if you start when you're 30 or 40, I think that the price you'll pay will be on your nervous system, your immune system, your digestive system, your reproductive system, and that will basically just lessen the length and the quality of your life.
Great point. Yeah. It is controversial.
You know, it is controversial. You know, there's some interesting studies published recently. One of them is that when they train Olympic athletes now, they go, the safest way to do it is that if you're training an athlete to run for 100 minutes, then for 80 minutes at least, you should be able to talk normally while you're running. Only for 10 minutes would you not be able to talk at all. And maybe for 10 minutes, talking might be labored. That's how they treat an Olympic athlete. Most people who exercise are not doing that. They're just stressing out the whole way through their exercise. The Olympic athlete is not being trained so they're going to live to 100. They're being trained till the next Olympics. That's all they care about. My suggestion is that maybe if you want to give people some sort of sympathetic nervous system exercise, then maybe only 1 to 5% of the time is enough for longevity. Maybe for 10% if you want to train an Olympic athlete. But really for the general public, what they're doing is basically nothing for most of the time, just sitting in a chair for 5 to 15 hours a day. And then you make them stress in an exercise class or a modern yoga class where they're just basically putting themselves into more stress. And that might give them limited benefits for anatomy and compromising their physiology.
I heard it said by a yoga teacher recently when she teaches people doing their class, and I was in a class with her, and she said to everyone, when you go into each pose, rather than going and trying to stretch to your limit, just only go to 80% and then breathe into the pose. Just let yourself naturally go into the pose as you breathe. So if you go deeper, is that good advice?
I think it's one step better. It's definitely a step in the right direction. But you have to ask, in your yoga practice, are you trying to create well-being or are you trying to increase flexibility? Because if your aim is to increase flexibility, then look for stretch. And that will make your body realize that actually it's inadequate. But if you want to feel yoga, yoga is a state where you could just say, the essence of yoga is to be happy with how you are. You know, that's what people say. Live in the present moment. Be connected with you in the present moment. So if I ask someone, do you want to get more flexible? They say, yes. I go, fine. You want flexibility. You don't want yoga. Do you want to get stronger? They say, yes, fine. You don't want yoga. Because if you want yoga, be happy with how flexible and how strong you are now. So if, for example, we look at the average person and you say, cross your arms, they cross their arms like this. When you cross your arms, does that feel like a stretch in your elbow? And your answer is usually, no, it doesn't feel like a stretch. Well, imagine if folding your elbow and flexing your elbow to its maximum, you felt a stretch. Well, you can't really stretch it anymore, can you? But if you felt a stretch and you folded your arm and went, gee, that's a good elbow stretch, your first thought would be, oh dear, something's wrong with my elbow. In fact, the body, whenever it perceives a stretch, will be thinking, oh dear, something's wrong. Maybe flight or fight response might start to be stimulated. Same with tension. Whenever the body experiences tension, it doesn't think I'm doing a strengthening exercise. It thinks something's wrong. And on a subconscious level, you trigger a flight or fight response where you start going, ooh, I'm not happy with how I am. I need change. And at the same time, you're probably dominating with sympathetic nervous system, turning off immune system, digestive system, reproductive system. And the subconscious emotions become fear, anger, aggression, lack of safety, which doesn't sound like yoga to me. If you want yoga, what you want to feel is, I feel safe. I feel perfect like I am. But if all you did was sit in a chair, you'll just get unfit. But if you can practice in a way like Matt's doing or the way I teach, where you're not feeling stretched, like in his Tai Chi or Qigong, Matt, I don't think you're feeling stretched, are you? You're just feeling good.
Not even necessarily feeling good. You're just feeling what's actually occurring in the moment.
What's actually occurring. But when you do these movements, which you see in Tai Chi, where you're just moving your arms back and forth, you're not feeling stretch, but you are enhancing mobility. So can you enhance mobility in the body without feeling stretch? That will give flexibility without feeling stretch. And even if you move into a position, you actually inhibit a stretch reflex. That's a big part of my work, is can I create flexibility without creating stretch? So for example, Indian yogi puts their leg behind their head. They do it with their palms on their chest. chest. In other words, they don't bring their leg behind the head by grabbing their leg and pulling it behind the head. They do it just by lifting their leg up and it goes behind their head. When the Indian yogi folds their legs into lotus posture, they don't use their hands. They put their legs into lotus the same way we cross our arms. Now, what that does on a neurological level is the muscle that they use to come into a position will switch on, it will become active, and it will reciprocally relax or inhibit or relax the muscle that they're trying to lengthen. So then a lengthened, relaxed muscle does not feel stretchy, but a muscle that is brought into a stretch by an external force, like one limb pulling another, or gravity or momentum, will initiate a stretch reflex. So what I'm saying essentially is that most people, when they do stretching exercises, are triggering stretch reflexes. And the stretch reflex is a muscle that has become lengthened and become tensed at the same time. But if you move actively into positions, as you do in Tai Chi or Qigong, where you're moving slowly and smoothly with muscles operating their own joints, then you won't feel a stretch reflex because you're inhibiting. And then you won't feel stretch, but you'll be encouraging strength without creating tension, and flexibility without feeling stretch. And this creates blood flow without making the heart go faster.
Which is exactly the way when Tim's teaching natural breathing, that's what you're doing with a capnometer, which is such a great device to actually see what that relaxation looks like.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because you're getting that immediate sort of biofeedback.
And like I said before, that if you can reestablish natural breathing in most people, that's a really good start for breath work. And there's so many different benefits you can get from breathing on many different levels. But I'm hoping to talk more with you both when you get a chance. And if we can meet in any of our cities at any stage, I'd love to speak to you both.
I can speak for both of us. That's our goal. When we chat next, if we can, certainly if not next, but as soon as possible, it would be great to meet.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Wow, what a fantastic interview with Simon Borg, Olivia. Such a wealth of information and such a fascinating person. His experience in yoga has been huge for many, many years in Australia. He's certainly been one of our leading practitioners of yoga for many, many years. Now he's teaching all over the world, and some absolutely fascinating stories shared. And just to sit there and hold your breath for 6.5 minutes and then enjoying it so much that you sort of accidentally go into an 8-minute breath hold afterwards is absolutely fascinating. If you'd like to learn more about Simon Borg Olivia and his work at Yoga Synergy, then go to www.yogasynergy.com.au and you'll find out about his work and his itinerary, etc. And also please subscribe to Take a Breath, and also jump on www.takeabreath.com.au. Have a look at some of the other interviews we've got on our podcast. Subscribe to our mailing list. Check out some of the books available and courses available on takeabreath.com.au. Thanks for joining us.
If you're stressed or depressed, anxious or just need a rest, if you're into your sport and you want to perform at your best, take a breath, take a breath, take a breath.